Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States has been doing a lot of war-making this last decade. At home, we've focused on body counts, policy disputes, whether the fights were smart and just. But we've barely absorbed a quiet revolution in how we fight. Listen.
U.S. drone strikes are continuing in Pakistan's northwest tribal area. 21.
Two armed U.S. Predator drones will be over Libyan airspace every day, tracking Gaddafi targets.
Ilyas Kashmiri was killed Friday evening in a U.S. drone strike in south Waziristan.
Drone strikes have long been reported in Pakistan and Yemen, but now there's news that a week ago, a U.S. drone aircraft fired on two leaders of the Somalian organization Al-Shabaab.
American drones, armed and ready to fire, are doing just that over half a dozen countries now. Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia. Drone capacity and drone numbers are exploding. Today, we'll look at the implications this hour on Point, drone wars. You can join the conversation. Are drones better than boots on the ground? And where will they take us and our thinking on war? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll speak to a top Predator drone pilot. But let's start with the man who's really written the book on drone warfare and more. P.W. Singer joins us from Washington. He is director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative at the Brookings Institution and author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Peter Singer, welcome back to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What's driving this enormous run-up in drone attacks and drone numbers being deployed by the U.S. military, Peter?
Well, we've got two factors coming into play. One is the sort of changing demands for these types of strikes. We're facing a new type of adversary. There's not a sort of clean victory or kill that you can have against them. You're not going to take Berlin and win the war. There's arguably the strategy being used against us is to sort of wear us down economically and also by body count. And so that has created an appeal for this kind of technology that allows you to carry out strikes without having to put as many boots on the ground. And then the flip side of it is that the technology is finally advanced to the point that it's useful. If we were having this discussion, say, 10 or 15 years ago, the technology like the Predator was too early on. So as an example, the Predator was available during Bosnia, but it hadn't been integrated with GPS. So you could fly the plane without having a pilot inside of it, but you didn't know where the plane was. You might have a video camera image of a tank on the ground, but you wouldn't know where in Bosnia it was. Now, with the combination of GPS, laser technology, et cetera, we're adding in that pinpoint precision. So it's this case of the technology and the demand side coming together. It's in war, it's like any other industry. You could have asked the same question about, say, you know, why have iPhones taken off right now? It's the combination of the technology and the demand kicking in. Same thing plays out in war.
Like any other industry, except, of course, that in another sense, it most certainly is not. You've written so compellingly across this whole range of robotic warfare. But take us through the kind of range of unmanned aerial vehicles or drones that are deployed right now and what's coming down the pike, Peter?
Well, I think the best illustration of how this is taking off is to look at it not just in numeric terms, but also the roles and functionalities that these systems are doing. So in numeric terms, literally when our forces went into Iraq in 2003, we had a handful of unmanned aerial systems in the air. And now we have over 7,000 in the U.S. military. And as you see that numbers ramp up, though, they're going out in all sorts of different size, shapes, and forms. So currently we use systems that range from hand-tossed drones like the Raven, which basically looks like a javelin, like a track star's javelin with wings. And it's actually launched that way. You run and you toss it and it flies away. And it allows a soldier to see what's on the other side of that hill or see what's going on in a building a couple city blocks away, which is, again, a capability that, you know, soldiers just a couple years ago didn't have. that goes up to the next level, the larger, more plane-like systems like the Predator that a lot of people are familiar with. It's the size of a Cessna. It actually flies with about the speed of a Cessna plane, under a couple hundred miles an hour, but it can stay in the air for as long as 20 hours. And so that gives you an amazing capacity. More importantly, has real high-powered sensors that allow it to pick up targets on the ground. And then at the high end, you have things like the Global Hawk, which is the robotic replacement for the U-2 spy plane. Now, what's interesting is that all of these systems, the technology is coming so fast. Just like that, you may have given your kid an iPod and now they're completely saying, this thing is an old piece of junk. I want the new thing. Same thing's happening with robotics. And so as an example, the Predator may be exciting sounding, but the U.S. military bought its last Predator last year. We're already using new versions. And the size and shape of these new versions range from ones like the Reaper, which is a direct replacement of the Predator. It, for example, can carry not just one missile like the Predator could, but 3,000 pounds of munitions, to we're now seeing prototypes for systems that range in size from insects, literally the size of an insect. I call them bugs with bugs, mm-hmm. Like James Bond spying device. To the other end of the spectrum, we have planes with wings the length of a football field that are stay up in the air not just for hours, but the goal is actually multiple months or even years. So it's like a robotic plane crossed with a spy satellite.
So it's quite a web of these now at work all around the world, some places where there's no active combat at all. But for example, observing North Korea, this Global Hawk, I think, has been deployed there, what you call the U-2 style spy plane. But the arresting figure is that we're now using these with live ammo and firing in half a dozen countries at this point, including countries in which there's no declaration of war. But that was part of the Obama administration's justification for not going to Congress on Libya. They said, look, this is just unmanned stuff. But yet it's there. And it's not just surveillance in Libya. Their explanation at the time was, periodically those U.S. drones just fire off missiles. It makes it pretty easy to move from observing to fighting.
Exactly. And I think that's why this is a revolutionary technology. The key to revolutionary technologies, the key to these kind of game-changing technologies, like in the past, the printing press or the atomic bomb or the steam engine, is not just that they're better than the last generation of technology. It's not just sort of improvements. It's the ripple effects that they have on the rest of the world around them, the ripple effects not just in science but in politics and law and ethics. And that's what's playing out here with robotics, with these unmanned systems. They're literally changing the way we look at war. They may be changing the way we define war. So as you put it, we're operating in six different countries right now, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya. And the scale of these operations would be ones that we would have called wars in the past. In Pakistan, for example, we carried out more than 200 airstrikes using unmanned systems. In Libya, we know that we've carried out over 30 airstrikes. But yet we see the president argue that, for example, this is not a war. He doesn't have to notify Congress in that way because, as you note, we're not sending troops into harm's way. We're just using unmanned systems. The same thing, the media cover these stories very differently. I mean, imagine, do we actually look at Pakistan right now as a war? But again, 200 airstrikes is actually larger in scale than the Kosovo war just mm-hmm. 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of this redefinition where maybe this thing that we used to call war, we're not calling war anymore. How are we defining the impact of something like the War Powers Resolution, which was supposed to kick in when we committed military force? But does the commitment of military force mean when you're putting boots on the ground, that's when the president has to notify? Or is it the actual use of force? Well, we've seen now the divergence of that argument, which, again, back in 1986 when they came up with this resolution, no one thought that you had to diverge the two because, well, you couldn't pull it off.
Certainly
when technology allows it.
Yeah, when you're on the ground in Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia or wherever, the missiles come down from these drones, it certainly feels like war from that end. Who's running the drones, Peter? Is it the Pentagon, the CIA, both? What's the line of division?
Well, that's another one of these big ripple effects that's, I think, key to it, is that this technology, with it, you're able to carry out acts of force. A Reaper is able to, launch over 3,000 pounds of munitions. And very, very precise systems, but you know, essentially capability that during World War II, as an example, you had to carry out 108 B-17 bomber strikes to hit one target. So 108 bombers had to go into harm's way just to get one bomb on one target.
Yeah.
Well, now with a system like the Reaper, you can, for example, hit as many as six targets. So incredible capability that, you know, would have taken the 8th Air Force to send in over 100 bombers. Well, in some of these operations, they're controlled by the military in locales like Iraq and Afghanistan, where we do have boots on the ground, where we do have sort of an admittance of ongoing military operation. Where it gets tricky, where it gets sticky from a legal standpoint, is these other operations where you may be utilizing a weapon of war, but you're doing it in a counterterrorism mode. You're doing it in a realm where it's a civilian intelligence agency that has the lead. You're doing it where you're trying to claim that it's covert, except the fact that we're talking about it right now means it's not so covert. But the point is there's an interesting difference between, say, an operation in Afghanistan or just across the border in Pakistan. In Afghanistan, the systems are openly operated by primarily the U.S. Air Force. It falls within a chain of command. The people that are operating them are in uniform. They are following orders all the way up to a four-star general in charge. The lawyers that are telling them what to do on rules of engagement decisions are military JAG officers. If for some reason something goes wrong, there's a court-martial system. Across the border?
Hold the border, Peter. We'll go to that. The CIA in Pakistan and who runs the drones there. Peter Singer is with us, author of Wired for War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about drone wars. U.S. airborne drones now striking in half a dozen countries. And looking at the world and future of drone warfare, Peter Singer is with us. He's author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. Peter, there in Washington, you were just beginning to sort of walk us through when the U.S. military runs the drones, when the CIA runs the drones, and what's the difference?
So a great example of this is what plays out between Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, right next door to each other. In Afghanistan, we've got tens of thousands of troops on the ground, and we also have unmanned aerial systems supporting them. And so those systems are under U.S. military control. The pilots that fly them are primarily in the U.S. Air Force. That means they're within the chain of command. That means the commander of their operations is a general in uniform. The lawyers who decide the tricky rules of engagement questions are military JAG officers. And if something goes awry, which sometimes does happen in war, there's a legal system, a military law system for figuring it out, a court-martial process. But just across the border in Pakistan, where we've carried out over 200 airstrikes using these systems, it's different. It's an operation that we don't openly admit to it. It's supposedly covert.
So much less transparency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's being operated by the CIA. That means the head of the operation is a civilian intelligence, a political appointee. The lawyers who decide the questions involved are general counsels in that agency. Now, notice I didn't say one was a good operation and the other was a bad operation. It's just a fundamentally different process for how you utilize force and who authorizes it, and also how you respond to everything from the political pressures that surround you to what do you do if something goes wrong. It's just a very different process.
The blending in many ways. I mean, David Petraeus is now headed over to the CIA right out of the heart of the U.S. military and that AFPAC operation.
Except when he joins the CIA, he will be a civilian and everyone underneath him will be a civilian. And if something goes wrong, civilian law is what at least should be applicable, except it gets very, very difficult to apply civilian law to, for example, was it okay to use my MQ-9 Reaper to drop a 500-pound munition on this target 7,000 miles away? That's not something that, you know, our civilian legal system is all that well equipped to deal with.
drones are very often seen as assassination targets. I mean, they've been right in the middle of war efforts in Iraq and beyond, but the CIA often using them to go after al-Qaeda leaders or other perceived threats to the U.S. But what about the legality? I mean, there was this report back in the spring that the U.N. was going to ask the CIA to stop drone strikes because under the Geneva Convention, that sort of power, life and death power of drones should be in the hands of regular armed forces, not intelligence services.
This is one of those areas where I might differ with how the UN has been interpreting it. There's a difference between the tactic and the technology. So what they were upset about was essentially what's been called targeted killings. Some people may call this assassination. Other people will call it, you know, precision strikes. But essentially it's targeted killings, going after an individual either in the realm of war or going after an individual in a counterterrorism effort. Now, that tactic, it really doesn't matter whether you're using a Predator drone or using a F-16. If your problem is with the tactic, that's what you care about. What the UN did, though, was conflate the tactic and the technology. And so that's a problem. Now, where the technology comes into it is something that I think you hit on earlier. It's not whether targeted killings are right and wrong. It's a question of does the fact that you're not having to think about sending someone into harm's way, does it make you more likely to use that tactic? I think a good illustration would be the difference between how we looked at the strikes in Pakistan, more than 200 of them, versus sending in SEAL Team 6 to get Osama bin Laden on the ground. The president's advisors, after the success of that mission, talked about how it was an incredibly gutsy call that he made to send those troops in on the ground. Now, what's interesting, though, is by them saying it, it also shows that they looked at the other 200 missions using the Predators mm-hmm. as not a gutsy call. That is something that didn't have the same kind of tough debate to make because there weren't sending boots on the ground. So it's not so much the tactic that is at the center of the sort of argument here. It's the idea, does not having to deploy force in a way that makes you concerned that I might, for example, have a pilot shot down, I might have a POW, does it make you look at it different? And it's not just the policymakers, but also the media, the rest of us. You know, do we look at Libya as a war right now? I don't think a lot of Americans talk about it, even though we are engaged in operations there.
Drone war seeping in all over the place here. When you hear government officials talk about surgical capabilities, that very often means something fired from an unmanned drone piloted from very far away. Could be in Langley in Washington or out in Nevada, Arizona. We're going to hear later in this hour from a drone pilot. Of course, I hope the questions of right and wrong are never taken out of this conversation. Certainly life and death here and civilian casualties. Another angle on this. Peter Singer, please stand by in Washington. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Monterey, California, John Arquilla, chairman of the Department of Defense Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School, author of many books, including his most recent Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits, How Masters of Irregular Warfare Have Shaped Our World. John Arquilla, welcome back to On Point. It's been a while. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
We've been talking with you about drone warfare, and the whole issue brought Robert E. Lee's meditations to mind. How so, John?
Well, Robert E. Lee said near the end of the Civil War, it is a good thing war is so terrible. Otherwise, we should grow too fond of it. And I'm afraid that drones are going to usher in a new age of intervention because they make war seem not so terrible.
Look at the Libya example. What do you see there?
Well, what I see is something that we wouldn't have gotten into at all, probably, unless we had this capability to reach out with unmanned strikes and surveillance. And we haven't been really very militarily involved. NATO has done most of the strike there, but we do provide a great deal of intelligence and make a lot of the campaign possible. I think the discussion about the War Powers Resolution is indeed impacted by the whole notion politically that, well, gee, we're basically just using drones, so we're not really at war. I think Peter's quite right. We have a situation here where, for a politician, this is almost a perfect storm, the ability to use force without the appearance of war.
A perfect storm or blitzkrieg. I mean, you had senior officials being quoted when Congress was saying, hey, wait a minute, where's the sign-off on Libya? And they were saying that, you know, there were plenty of drones in there, and the U.S. was providing refueling and surveillance. And then just sort of as casually, although remotely piloted drones operated by the United States periodically fire missiles, too. And they argued that the U.S. forces are at little risk. therefore, you know, why have war? Because there are no troops on the ground. And according to the New York Times reporting here, Libyan forces are unable to exchange fire with them meaningfully because it's coming from a drone. So, of course, you know, so there's no conflict, so there's no war. And yet there we are, John.
Yeah, not only do we have a war, but on the ground we have a stalemate, and a lot of people are getting killed on both sides. And we have to look at this from a larger perspective. While politically this may be attractive, strategically, the drone is not yet changing the age-old problem of the strategic use of air power, which is that it doesn't work. We've spent over 70 years trying to make strategic bombing campaigns work. And right now, the philosopher's stone for military leaders is the drone. The idea, there's low risk, high precision. We only need one of these, not 100 B-17, mm-hmm. knock out a bridge. This is wonderful. But actually, what has the intervention done in Libya? It has led to a stalemate on the ground and a war that's going to grind on. And the French are now saying, maybe we don't stay in. Maybe we negotiate with Gaddafi. I worry about something I call the law of the instrument. When you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And we have a shiny new hammer with these drones.
A whole lot of them, thousands and many more of many different sizes and capacities coming on stream. Now, you say it doesn't work, but the Obama administration, which has really ramped up drone use, particularly in Pakistan, makes a whole lot of the many al-Qaeda leaders who are now gone, and a lot of them gone through drone attacks.
Well, this is another of the problems. We're focused on leaders. If you listen to Secretary Panetta the other day, he said al-Qaeda's on the ropes because we're knocking out one leader after another. The problem is al-Qaeda's a network operating in 60 countries. And how many times have we killed number three in al-Qaeda? We admit to having killed number three 20 times. The problem is in a network, everybody's number three. So this also, aside from the attempt to shore up strategic air attack, there is also the shoring up of the idea of what they call counter-leadership targeting. And neither of these has worked particularly well against networks, are not going to do well. Something people should pay attention to is something Secretary Panetta said in his confirmation hearings, that he, and I was amazed to hear this openly, he said there were 1,000 al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. That's what you need to worry about, not number three or number one even in the organization. How did they get 1,000 people into Iraq? And why? They're getting ready to mount an offensive as we leave. So it's pretty clear al-Qaeda's on its feet. The bombing with drones has not hurt them fatally, and the loss of leaders has simply self-selected ever more resilient operatives who are now filtering back into Iraq. And as we draw down from Afghanistan, they'll become more active there. And look out, because they'll attack in other places as well.
And meanwhile, behind the American example, many, many more countries pouring into this drone battlefield, growing their own capacity. We'll look at that. I want to bring our listeners in. John Arquilla, Peter Singer, please stand by. Michael is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm very disturbed, I guess, by two things about the use of these drones. You know, first would be the civilian deaths. The military and the CIA, they always say that everyone killed was a terrorist, but then later we often find out that there were a lot of civilians involved.
Yes.
And of course, these people are never tried. They're just killed. And then second, I'm also disturbed by the proliferation of U.S. wars around the planet. And it seems that it's easier to have these small scale wars. They're undeclared, and they're, you know, there seems to be no end to them.
And drones, as John Arquilla says, make them easy. Peter Singer, let's talk about proliferation. Michael raises it here. What about other countries and drones? This is not only the United States anymore, Peter.
I think it's real important to recognize that we're at the early stage of this revolution, and it's not just the technology is getting better and better, where, you know, it's moving from being completely remotely piloted to systems starting to be able to take on more and more autonomy, you know, for example, take off and land on their own, or some automated smart sensors and the like. We're not in the land of Terminator yet, but the technology gets better each year. But then the other part of it is the technology proliferates. So how we operate with this technology is important, but guess what? There's 44 other nations besides the United States that are building, buying, and using military robotics. And some of those nations are allies like Great Britain. Other of them are nations that are maybe of more concern, like China, Russia, Iran. And then one of the other aspects is there's this sort of idea that, oh, we can hit them, but they can never hit us. But even in the realm of terrorism, this is becoming a concern, where besides nations, there's a range of non-state actors, including a couple terrorist groups that have started to show interest in using unmanned systems. As an example, Hezbollah is a group that a lot of people believe to be the equivalent of a terrorist group. It has operated these systems, for example, during its war with Israel just a couple years ago. So that proliferation is something that is quite global. This is not just a, you know, arguably an American revolution.
Israel very active in this also, sold anti-radar attack drone to China. Pentagon got pretty hot about that, sold, according to WikiLeaks, sold sophisticated drones to Russia. I mean, it's nations large and small here. What does that mean down the road when it's not just, you know, when it's very obvious that it's not just American predators flying around up there? Are we going to have a bunch of, I mean, science fiction's been here for a long time, but everybody with their kind of, you know, orbiting drone platform for launches up there, Peter?
Well, you know, where this to me gets fascinating is that we've just had this discussion sort of limiting it to the realm of war. But, you know, if this is like the computer in 1980, which is a parallel that Bill Gates has made to robotics today. Well, you know, guess what? The computer used to be something that primarily the military used, the military did research and development on, and then it proliferated not just globally, but also to the civilian side. And we're seeing the same thing happen with these systems. So, you know, as an example, we've talked about the Predator as a military technology, but it's already being used by Customs and Border Patrol along the U.S.-Mexico and the U.S.-Canada border. There's a number of local police departments that have bought what used to be military-style systems and used themselves. As an example, Miami-Dade Police Department just got a special license to use a system that had originally been designed as a tiny drone for the U.S. Army. And where this really takes off is that Congress has argued that by the year 2015, we need to open up the airspace. This is going to raise a whole new level of
U.S.
legal
airspace for drone flight, you're saying?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And so what this creates is, you know, constitutional level questions of privacy and probable cause when you move some of the types of operations that we've seen externally into the U.S. I'm not saying carrying out airstrikes here. Let me be clear. I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theory person mm-hmm. or anything like that. I'm just talking about the ability to park an all-seeing eye in the sky over a city.
Or now, a little tiny one in your backyard. I mean, having read all this, I was on the back patio last night. There was a dragonfly. I'm reading all these stories about insect-sized surveillance somewhere down the road. You know, in I don't know, 2030, maybe we won't know if it's an insect or something else. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa, if I may. Norma, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think probably you've just been discussing a lot of the things that concern me, and that is that you know, you don't have to be a government to apparently develop or acquire this drone warfare capability. And I'm wondering what the panel thinks when somebody starts sending drones over us and bombs or does whatever they want.
Whatever they may carry. Norma, our time is short before the break, but let me pick it up right there. John Arquilla, what about that threat? Are we immune?
No, we're not immune, but it's not that great a threat. These things are not hard to shoot down. You know, the first cruise missiles in World War II, over half of them were shot down by British air defenses in 1944. Our first sort of guided missiles, and our Tomahawk missiles are a kind of robot themselves. Anyway, these drones can't operate where we don't have air mastery, and that's another point to remember as we build thousands and thousands of these. We operate in permissive environments, but in a shooting war against an opponent with real capabilities, these drones would fall by the hundreds and pretty easily. So I don't think we want to panic people about the coming of the drones. But in these dark and drafty parts of the world where these insurgencies go on and the insurgents look up at the sky, you raised the sci-fi image a moment ago. You know, to them, this is as good as fighting aliens, this new technology. And it seems to me that what we have to remember also is that the more we use these things, the greater the sense of resistance and outrage we kindle in those that we're striking against.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about drone wars. U.S. airborne drones now striking in half a dozen countries, and looking at the world and Future of Drone Warfare. P.W. Singer joins us from Washington, author of the terrific book Wired for War. John Arquilla is with us, chairman of the Department of Defense Analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. His latest book, Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits. Joining us right now from New Mexico, an undisclosed location in New Mexico, is Matt J. Martin. He's author of Predator, the Remote Control Air War Over Iraq and Afghanistan, a pilot's story. He's a U.S. Air Force pilot. He flew, quote-unquote, Predator combat and surveillance missions over Afghanistan and Iraq from 04 to 08. He now trains future unmanned aerial vehicle pilots for the U.S. Air Force. Matt Martin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure. I do have to correct you, though. We prefer the term remotely piloted aircraft.
Remotely piloted aircraft. We'll give you that. You've flown in cockpits, and you've flown, you know, virtually from a distance. What's the difference in terms of your human interaction with what you're doing, Matt, if you're whether you're in the cockpit up in the air or in a control center thousands of miles from the battlefield?
Well, I can tell you, Tom, that originally it's, you know, when you first learn how to fly these airplanes, it's a little bit disorienting. It takes a little bit of time and training to get used to controlling an aircraft from thousands of miles away. But I can tell you that you know, the reason we don't like to call them drones is because that sort of implies that they're, you know, autonomous robots that are flying around without much human interaction. But the Predator that I flew, the MQ-1, is really a hands-on stick and rudder type of airplane. It really requires the control of a team of aviators. And I can tell you that after a little bit of time in the left seat of a ground control station, you kind of forget that you're not on board the airplane because you're talking to forward air controllers over the radio. You're controlling the aircraft through conventional stick and rudder inputs. And in no time at all, you forget that you're not actually there.
So you're sitting in New Mexico. Your target may be in Iraq or Afghanistan or these days Somalia or Yemen. What's the look-down capacity like as a pilot? I mean, what can you see on the ground from a drone or, as you say, remotely piloted vehicle that may be many thousands of feet in the air?
Well, my experience was flying combat missions over Iraq and Afghanistan. Typically, we fly around at about 10,000 feet, and so I'm looking through a targeting pod that's on board the aircraft. I can see individuals moving around to the point where I can, you know, with a little bit of training and understanding of the way people move around, I can tell the difference between the ground troops that I'm supporting versus civilians versus the enemy movement. I can certainly track vehicles, et cetera. And I'm just constantly looking through that that real-time video feed to do all that.
Can you see the people on the ground? I mean, have you ever seen them sort of look up, realize you're there, and start running?
Occasionally, you know, when we fly up at 10,000 feet, the airplanes are going to be really hard to see. Sometimes when you're out in a very rural area, they might be able to hear the sound of the aircraft engine. Because, you know, we have this persistent capability, and we've been so good over the years at being able to provide that direct support to troops on the ground, when you're looking at insurgents or an IED team or a mortar team, they understand that there's a danger there, and if they hear that airplane, they're definitely going to respond to it.
Matt, we've got questions from our listeners for you, and I want to bring some of them in here. Bolton, Connecticut, Heather is calling. Heather, you're on the air with remote piloted vehicle trainer Matt Martin.
Hi, Tom. My thoughts are that in history, a king, a leader, possibly a president, would have to be on the front lines of any war that we fought, anything to that effect. He gained respect from it. He was honored by his people. And now, with things like drones, we have no risk to ourselves other than blowback. We're playing God, killing civilians, basically causing genocide. And do these people have no way of protecting themselves because they're from a lower income? And basically, I think we're eventually going to fall off our pedestal and realize that we've lost the respect of all the people of the world, and we're just having kids press buttons eventually.
Heather, is it genocide if they're targeting Al-Qaeda leaders?
It's genocide when you know that the opposite. There's never been a war when they have been able to pinpoint, take out one person without taking out other people who are under the control of another person,
yep.
or who were innocent civilians who just happened to be in the area, whose children are witnessing this, whose cultures have no control over what choices their government or our government is making.
Heather, I appreciate your call. Matt Martin, here you are. You're the pilot. You've done it. You hear that perspective. The Heather wonders about the risk of a loss of stature, almost of nobility, as she's describing, that we seem like aliens in the sky. What about that?
Well, you know, Tom, I can't speak to what's going on in the minds of political leaders, but I can tell you that the crews who are flying these aircraft are not, I'm afraid I have to take issue there. They are not kids pushing buttons. They are trained aviators, and I can tell you that we take the exact same consideration. We get the exact same training, and we are just as serious about our jobs as individuals who are flying manned aircraft. In fact, we all have experience in previous manned aircraft. I used to fly the RC-135, and so I didn't approach this job any differently than flying those previous manned combat missions.
But you're a smart guy. You're a human being. You can see what she's getting at there. If it's coming down from the sky and they know there's nobody in there, you're sitting back in Nevada. What about the risk of alienating populations where these vehicles are flying over and shooting down?
Well, you know, I suppose that's a risk. But that's always been kind of a risk of counterinsurgency. You know, all the missions I flew were in direct support of ground units. We didn't very often go out and do missions that were just, independent missions. And so you certainly have to take that into account when you're doing counterinsurgency to make sure that your ground elements that are engaging the population are able to, prevent that.
Ross in Boston, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Ross.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Would drone attacks legalize or legitimize subsequent retaliations on American soil, say by a bombing, something that would in the past be regarded as cowardly or illegal, but would now be more legitimate in the eyes of the world or whatever governing body would look at it? I mean, I'm essentially in more danger of a retaliation than this guy in Mexico as an American civilian.
That is interesting. Let me look at it from a couple of angles. Matt Martin, we're not saying exactly where you are in New Mexico, and maybe for just this concern, how are you instructed by your superiors there? Are you, as a drone pilot, a combatant? Are you a legitimate target for an enemy of the United States, even sitting in New Mexico, driving home from work?
You know, there was some recent discussion of this and some recent articles. I think the consensus was that, you know, when you are sitting there in the cockpit flying the aircraft, you have the same military status as anyone who is deployed forward. When you're driving home to work, you're just a guy driving home from work. So I think you'd have to just think about it in terms of what you're actually doing at the time.
Peter Singer, what about this point and the parsing that Matt does there?
I think it hits, again, one of these aspects of how revolutionary this technology is, that it's really redefining the very notion of going to war, both for the nation but also for the individual. So for the nation, you know, going to war used to be a big political commitment. It was a tough decision. It sometimes put the nation's survival at stake. And yet we've, you know, talked about the idea that we're using force in six different countries and kind of don't feel ourselves at war other than maybe at the airport. That is, our military is at war, but is the nation at war? And then you have the notion of going to war for the individual. So as he puts it, you know, when he's in the cockpit, he is at war. He is a defined combatant. He is within a chain of command. But then there's that idea of the commute to and from work. Are you at war then? Well, you know, this is a fun – no pilot in, for example, World War II would have described it that way. It's a difference. It's a change. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that's coming out of this is you're seeing the fundamental difference between operations within a military chain of command in support of troops on the ground in places like in Iraq or Afghanistan versus the more fuzzy questions that surround operations like a Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia, where many of these questions, the answers would have been very different if, for example, you were chatting with, say, a CIA operator, which, of course, we don't because we don't openly admit to those operations. It's not within a defined chain of command. There's not all of the issues that have been resolved by the U.S. Air Force. So, you know, we are at a historic turning point with this.
Matt Martin, one more question for you there in New Mexico. John in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on with our pilot, our drone pilot, John.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, with the increasing prevalence of hacking, what are the risks, in fact, that, you know, these drones get hacked? I mean, what are the implications if someone jailbreaks a drone? And what does that mean? I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, John. What about it, Matt? Somebody takes over a Predator or a Reaper with 3,000 pounds of munitions, hacks in and sends it where it wants it to go to do whatever. What's the risk, Matt?
Well, you know, I would say, I mean, these are very sophisticated systems. We take a lot of precautions to make sure that sort of thing isn't probable, much less possible. I can tell you in my experience flying these aircraft for the last 8 years, it has never been a serious consideration because we've taken those precautions. And I would also point out that a lot of our other manned aircraft have the same type of very sophisticated avionic systems that have data links to points on the ground, and therefore it's not just a vulnerability for remotely piloted aircraft.
Matt J. Martin, author of Predator, now training unmanned aerial vehicle pilots for the U.S. Air Force in New Mexico. Matt, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, and I just got to remind you, my opinions don't necessarily represent those of the U.S. Air Force or the Department of Defense.
Duly noted. Thank you, Matt. John Urquilla, we've seen people very close to David Petraeus with big concerns and doubts about this. David Kilcullen out of Australia, who came in and did a lot of counterinsurgency consultation with the U.S. military, and Petraeus in particular, objecting on the drone front, saying, you know, you're not engaging on the ground. You're not winning hearts and minds. What about that argument?
Oh, it's a good argument, and it really tracks with something Matt said a few moments ago. You know, he operated mostly in conjunction with our forces on the ground, and that's when these remotely piloted vehicles can be most effective. The guys on the ground can be talking with them, they can be sharing intelligence back and forth, and they can become very precise and very effective in the role of close support. The area where it gets a lot more iffy is when the predators are being used in a strategic way, that is across a border somewhere without those guys on the ground. Yes, maybe there's a spy or two or some friendly local helping them, but they're a lot less effective because one of the things Matt didn't say is that looking down from that predator is really like looking down through a soda straw. It's not the same thing as a pilot in a cockpit looking around and getting a big view. So you really need people nearby to help guide this. And I think this is one of the reasons that the strategic use against an insurgency or against any other kind of adversary is a lot more problematic. And I think particularly when we talk about Pakistan here, 200 strikes over a period of a couple of years is not enough to make a difference. You know, in the Kosovo war that Peter alluded to earlier, it was hundreds of strikes every single day for 78 days to convince the Serbs to get out of Dodge. The pace is far too slow, even now, to make a difference in a campaign, and I think people need to realize there are these limitations, as well as the risk. The more we keep going over the border in this way, killing innocent people from time to time, the greater the resentment we kindle. People who've been bombed strategically for the last 70 years have always kindled a great resentment of those who've been bombing them. It's true of the German people, of the Vietnamese people. In the Korean War, we leveled every building in Pyongyang and still only got a draw out of that war. People don't bend or break under bombing, and they won't under predators.
So far, it's felt kind of like a cakewalk, this drone business. Even a subject for humor last year at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, President Obama made a joke about using predator drones to keep young men at bay from his daughters. He's talking about the Jonas Brothers, the musicians in the audience. Here's the president.
Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming.
Peter Singer, you say drones are like the new computers, that they're not going to go away. They're a fact of life and they're coming on. What evolution of warfare and going war do you anticipate? Look out into the future, Peter. Where are we headed here?
These technologies are going to change in a lot of different ways. And I think that's one of the other things that's colored our discussion where, you know, we're talking about where they are right now. So, you know, the idea of it being remotely piloted completely, well, that's changing. Or the idea of the sensor system, the experience being like looking through a single soda straw. Well, there's already a new version out that is gives you wide area lens and allows you to track 92 different targets at once. I mean, what I'm getting at is the technology is always evolving, and I think it's evolving in its size, shape, and form, you know, ranging in size from insects to, you know, large football length size systems to the technology is getting smarter. That is, you know, we this was World War II. We make a comparison between the B-17 and the B-24. One could fly further, faster, carry more bombs. That's the same difference between the MQ-1 that Matt Martin flew to the MQ-9 right now that's flying.
But Peter, let me ask you. I'm looking here. This is a study done by the Ministry of Defense in the UK where they're also putting drones to work. And they're warning about a, quote, incremental and involuntary journey toward a Terminator-like reality, talking about James Cameron's 1984 film, saying that Britain has to establish a policy to decide what is acceptable machine behavior. They write, it's essential we ensure we do not risk losing our controlling humanity and make war more likely. Is that the direction, Peter? Or is it like, oh my gosh, this is too much, we've got to pull back?
Well, we're putting more and more intelligence into our systems, and they're gaining more and more autonomy. They're making more and more of their own decisions, and that is a fundamental breakpoint in war. You know, it's not a gun that shoots further. It's not a gun that shoots faster. It's a system that has more and more intelligence to it, and so we're entering a new era. Now, the question is, you know, are we going to stop? No. The reality is this technology is here to stay. They're very useful in war. They were constantly pushing the edge of science. And then finally, there's a lot of money to be made in this. This is the one part of the defense budget that's growing. So, you know, it's again, it's sort of like asking, you know, in 1980, mm-hmm. are computers good or bad? Are we going to stop? No. You know, they're both the ways that they'll be used is both good and bad, but also they're just going to continue to change our world.
We've got a
and
big heads up here today. With that, we're out of time. Peter Singer, author of Wired for War, thank you for being with us. And John Arquilla, Insurgents, Raiders, and Bandits. His new book out of Monterey, California. Thank you, John, as well. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.